From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Hurricane Florence recovery continues today as federal aid arrives in the Carolinas. FEMA is on the ground now in North Carolina in New Hanover County. That's where Wilmington and other towns are still tough to access because of road conditions. Schools there remain closed. Tim Markley is superintendent of New Hanover County Schools. And Tim, thanks for taking a few minutes to speak to us.
Well, thank you for giving me a call.
As I said there, you're a school administrator, but I think your job has probably morphed a lot in the past week or so. How are you spending your days now, days like today?
Today is about getting our schools back up and running. We've got contractors in a number of our schools to get the buildings back into shape. We had some extensive flooding. We've been working with our state officials on issues such as calendar, working with our insurance folks on funding. So there's just a number of different things going on right now.
You said flooding. What specifically is the nature of the damage, and in what percent of the schools there?
Well, I mean, we have 44 schools. Nearly all of them had some kind of water damage, from minor to extensive. We probably have a dozen schools that are going to require a lot of work to get them back up and running.
Work of what nature?
Well, we were fortunate we didn't lose a roof, but we did have several pipes break that have leaked into buildings and classrooms, and so we're going to have to get the water out of those buildings. We're going to have to look at the equipment in those rooms to see what was damaged. So there's still a lot of work to do.
How soon do you expect the children there will be able to get back into those classrooms?
I am hoping that we can, after, we'll probably be out another week, but can start getting students back into school the week after next.
When they come back, I'm guessing that a lot of those students probably will have had to have evacuated their homes. Maybe some of them won't be back again. What kind of accommodations can you make for those students?
Well, and that's something we're already working on. And it's not going to be just our students. I was working a shelter during the storm, and one of my teachers walked into that shelter. Her house had been flooded out. And so we're going to ask her to come back in a couple of weeks and start teaching class. That's going to be a very difficult task for the adults as well as the students.
So what do you do then?
We're going to provide as much support as we can. Our counselors, our mental health folks are going to be on site. A lot of our students are going to come back to homes and they've lost all their clothing and such, and so we'll be working with different relief agencies to make sure that they've got supplies. We'll work with some of our local groups, making sure that we can get meals to those students, so that when they go home, they can get a meal. It's going to be a lot of things and a community-wide effort.
A community-wide effort, meaning bringing in resources from other groups or from FEMA or what?
A little bit of both. We've got a lot of resources in our community, but we're going to have to tap those resources and then look at some outside groups such as FEMA.
Have you been in any kind of touch with students from the system since the hurricane struck?
Yeah, our principals are reaching out, trying to make contact with those students to check on them. Part of the problem is we have 44 schools, but 20 of those principals evacuated. So I've got to get them back into town as well to start making those contacts.
One of your high schools is being used as a shelter. Can you tell us what's happening there? How many people are there?
Yeah. When the storm broke, five of our schools opened up as shelters. They've consolidated those down to one main shelter, which has about 600 people. We're also running a second shelter that's being staffed by the hospital to handle a medical overflow. So we don't know when those folks will go back. It could be sometime next week. It may be a little bit longer. And that will also impact when we can get back into school.
Right. And have you been, by the way, to that high school to see what's going on?
Yeah, I check on that high school every day as well as the medical shelter.
What's it like?
I mean, you've got two gyms that it's full of folks on cot. It can't be good for the folks who are there, but there's a lot of community resources there. Our county management and emergency services have staffed the place. There's medical. So I think those folks want to get back to their homes and there's some normalcy, but it's gonna take a while.
Tim Markley, thank you very much. Tim Markley, superintendent of New Hanover County Schools in North Carolina. Nice to speak with you and good luck.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your support.
Well, now to a standoff in the steel industry that could lead to one of the largest strikes in years. Steelworkers are in contract negotiations with two of the country's largest steel producers, U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal. The old contract expired at the start of September, and the workers have now authorized a strike against both companies. Workers say they're not benefiting from the industry's rising profits, brought on partly by the president's 25% tariff on steel imports. Leo Girard is the president of United Steelworkers International. He joins us from Pittsburgh. Welcome.
Glad to be with you.
So around 16,000 workers at U.S. Steel and 15,000 at ArcelorMittal have authorized strikes. When do you think strikes will happen, or will they?
Well, look, that depends on the progress or lack of progress we make at negotiations. Our members are frustrated and angry at most of those two major companies at all facilities. And our union has played a very, very, very key role for the last 20 years of struggling every day to help the steel industry survive. We went through a period in the 2003, roughly, where there were 40 bankruptcies. In the last collective agreement at both Arcelor and U.S. Steel, our members took 3 years with no wage increase or benefit improvements because the company was, again, teetering. Now they're going to make $2 billion roughly at the U.S. Steel and substantially the same kind of amount at ArcelorMittal. And they come asking for concessions. They play hide the pea. They give us wage increase, but then tell us they're going to take away our incentive programs. They want a six-year agreement when we don't know what the industry will be doing 6 months, 6 years from now. It's kind of off in the distance, and we're not going to settle for a six-year deal.
Well, U.S. Steel is offering a six-year deal that would give a raise of 4% in the first year and 3% every year after that. Is that not good enough, you think?
Look, it's an illusion. They're offering that kind of number, but at the same time converting our health care program to a high-deductible program. And that would cost our members almost double what they're costing now for health care. So they give it to you with one hand and take it away with the other. And, you know, it's an insult that they think that we're not smart enough to figure that out. That's why our members are so angry.
If your workers strike, could that hurt some of the progress the industry has been making, do you think?
Let me make it real clear. We're not going to take the responsibility for a labor dispute. We didn't come here with a greedy approach. We came here with an approach to have a fair contract and continue our struggle together to make sure the industry survives. We were prepared to bargain that they'd make capital improvements. We know lots of our facilities need capital improvements, and so we want to talk about that. We're not looking for a strike. We'd like to get a settlement, but if they push us over the cliff, then they'll get what they got, and we'll fight it out.
The reason that they are doing, or one of the big reasons that they're doing so well right now, is because of the tariffs which you supported, President Trump's steel tariffs. Do you think that those tariffs have been good policy overall or just for you?
No, look, I think, half information is correct, half is not correct. The industry started to turn around before the Trump tariffs. In fact, the industry was starting to turn around in the last year or so as a result of work that we had done on productivity, the work that we had done on bad trade with trade cases we've had in a number of countries that were cheaters, and that started to have an impact. And there's no doubt that the percentage by President Trump has added some help to that. But they were on their way to making money before that. And so What is troubling is that not only the tariff increase, but they're also going to get a huge benefit from the tax changes down to 21%. And while they're doing that, they want to shift the tax burden for healthcare onto our members. I mean, again, it's hide the pea, and they think we can't figure it out. Well, we have.
So from what I'm hearing from you, it sounds like you probably are going to go on strike.
Well, look, don't make any assumptions. It's up to the company. I'll repeat to you and to the listeners, they're going to make over $2 billion this year. In the last 3 years, they made no profit, but they paid themselves $50 million in bonuses, the top five officers, while we took no wage increase and no benefit improvements. Now we're coming to the bargaining table and saying a couple of simple things. Leave our health care alone. Let's talk about capital improvements that we need to make, and let's bargain a fair wage increase for the times.
Mr. Girard, one more question. How long do you think that the tariffs are going to remain in place on steel and aluminum?
I haven't got a clue. There's been all kinds of comments by all kinds of folks on both sides of the issue, and I know this. The United Steelworkers of America have taken on the challenge of confronting unfair trade and filed trade cases against countries that cheat, South Korea, China, Indonesia, India, Malaysia, a lot of countries that actually don't play by the trade rules that we already think are weak. But even with those weakened trade rules, we've won many, many trade cases, and we've done that together with the industry, and we're going to continue to do it, tariff or no tariff.
That's Leo Girard, who is president of United Steelworkers International. Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be with you. Thank you for letting me be on.
ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, is an especially cruel and debilitating neurodegenerative disease. People who are diagnosed with it often succumb within 2 to 5 years. There's a group of people with ALS living at a center outside Boston, and they're living longer and more meaningful lives than ever thought possible. The place is the Leonard Florence Center for Living. It's a skilled nursing facility in a contemporary brick building along a hillside in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Inside, something revolutionary is happening, thanks to two men who make an unlikely pair. First, Barry Berman. He's a gentle, avuncular 64-year-old who comes to work in a pullover and a tie and loves what he does. He runs the center.
I think I have the best job in the world because I go to work every day, and my mission is just to try to make people have a better quality of life.
The other half of the pair is 49-year-old Steve Sailing, a self-proclaimed rebel with long blondish hair and a penchant for T-shirts and Birkenstocks. He lives at the center because he has ALS.
I was told my life expectancy was between 3 and 5 years. I've always had a problem with authority. I don't like to accept what makes no sense to me.
Sailing was diagnosed 12 years ago. His arms and legs are paralyzed now. He communicates through a computer because ALS took away his voice. He uses a tiny mouse, a metallic circle, on the bridge of his glasses to point at words and letters scrolling rapid fire on a computer screen. The computer is mounted to his wheelchair. It takes a few minutes for him to piece together a sentence. Sailing is blunt about his condition.
I am completely dependent on others, and will be for the rest of my life. I require help if I want to have my position changed at night. I cannot scratch my head or rub my eyes, even when an eyelash gets in there.
Sailing used to work as a landscape architect. In fact, he specialized in making public spaces accessible for the disabled, including the Rose Kennedy Greenway in Boston. When he was diagnosed with ALS, he had a newborn son. Sailing had always liked to noodle around with technology, a real Inspector Gadget, he says. That passion, his need for long-term nursing care, and Barry Berman's vision of nursing care converged. Berman recalls when the two were introduced at an ALS conference in Boston.
From this point on, I do believe a higher power just took over and made this happen.
Berman was on a mission to reconceptualize the design of a traditional nursing home to make it more like a residence that happens to have state-of-the-art nursing care. He envisioned private bedrooms opening up to a communal living area. It would be nonprofit. Berman says Steve Sailing was all about customizing technology for people with disabilities.
And Steve single-handedly designed a household where he would live the rest of his life and have all the technology and the care that he would need so he could lead an independent life.
The place is wired with computers that help residents do things their hands can't do. Sailing says the individual components of the system are off-the-shelf stuff and just need Wi-Fi and a browser. He worked with a home automation software company to tailor the system for people with disabilities. Sailing leads us on a tour from his wheelchair.
This is the bakery and cafe. We have a full-time baker who makes amazing homemade fresh pastry daily. There is a 15-foot screen that drops from the ceiling for movies and events, like the Super Bowl.
Down the hall, there's a chapel with stained glass windows. Farther down, there's a day spa with a massage therapist. People with ALS can still feel the touch of a hand. Sailing moves his head ever so slightly to aim at an infrared dot on the wall that lets him call for the elevator. He selects the third floor. We step out to a sunny foyer. The floor is called the Steve Sailing ALS Residence. It's one of two ALS floors. Each has 10 rooms. There's a mailbox and a doorbell. No need to ring it, though. Sailing opens the door with a signal to his computer.
Welcome to my home. By looking, you would never know that this is a nursing home. We are in the living room now, complete with that electric fireplace.
There's a pristine kitchen and a long woodblock dining table. Residents create their own menus, even if they're on a feeding tube, as Sailing is. And when he wants a drink, Sailing's a bourbon man, he takes a shot of Maker's Mark through the tube. He leads us to his bedroom.
I can control the lights, the window shade, the thermostat, the TV, and home theater, and any electrical device, like my fan.
He turns on the TV, ESPN. There are dozens of books and CDs, including his favorite Stones album.
Sticky Fingers.
The walls are raspberry. His mom painted them. They're covered with framed family photos and a huge surrealistic painting he once made. There's also a private bathroom with a ceiling lift that, with the help of staff, carries Sailing from his wheelchair to the shower or toilet.
I even have a remote-controlled bidet to wash and dry my bum so that I maintain that independence.
Every human being is entitled to good care and to live with dignity.
Again, CEO Barry Berman.
Many of our ALS residents, when they have been admitted here, hadn't experienced a shower in several years. We take our ventilator residents in the shower and people have showers. That's human dignity, that every human being should have warm water cascading over their body. That's not innovative. But when we give someone on a ventilator a shower, it takes four people.
Many of the residents here with ALS have lived well beyond their prognoses. Barry Berman believes that's partly because of the quality of the care. He says there are two or three times as many nurses and aides on duty than in a typical nursing home. And they know the residents so well, they can immediately spot an infection and keep them out of the emergency room.
Because of that, we sometimes go 6 months, we could go a year without an empty bed. And when you average two or three calls a week from desperate people throughout the country and around the world, it's really heartbreaking. We weren't prepared for people living as long as they're living here.
So that's clearly a blessing, but it also increases the demand for beds that you don't have open.
Exactly. And one time I just noticed our admissions person was in tears. And I said, what's the matter? What did something happen? She said, I just can't take all these ALS calls.
It costs the center $50,000 a year to take care of each resident with ALS. That's after Medicaid, and nearly all of them are on Medicaid. Barry Berman's goal is to replicate this home, but that won't happen without more philanthropy. As for Steve Sailing, he can't wait for the day when everyone has access to this kind of technology and care. For now, he savors what he and Berman have created.
The most satisfying part of my day would have to be towards the end of the day. Especially when I have a particularly productive day. When I can medicate with cannabis, kick my feet up, and watch a good movie in my home theater. It is relaxing and very satisfying.
He says life is good. For photos of Steve Sailing and the ALS residents at the Leonard Florence Center for Living, go to our website, hereandnow.org. There was a memorial service in Lake Oswego, Oregon this past weekend for a woman that we want to remember now. Her name was Kathy Krieger. She died suddenly this past summer, and she left behind a legacy far away in Morocco. Not just anywhere in Morocco. Here's a hint.
He's looking at you, kid.
Kathy Krieger defeated the odds and created Rick's Cafe in Casablanca, Morocco. There never was a Rick's, despite the iconic place and the iconic film. Krieger saw an opportunity and seized it. She found a stately old riad, a building in the ancient Medina. It was not the kind of place you'd want to walk around at night. It was a wreck.
It was challenging, but I could see the potential. I mean, the courtyard was here. The balustrade was here. I could just picture the movie, and scenes came back to me. Everything else was falling apart. The floors were cracked, parts of the walls that were chipped, and the marble in the center was all cracked, and there was a fountain that was in pieces.
To make the place look like Rick's, it took money. It wasn't easy as an American woman and a single mom to get the funding. She went to 16 banks for loans before she finally got the money, but she needed more.
So I decided I'd put together a flyer, and I used lines from the movie. In the top of the flyer, it said, "Rounding up the usual suspects." And at the last line, it said, "Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, I'd like you to buy into mine." And so I asked them to put up $5,000.
She told us at Rick's a few years ago that she way overspent on lights, the drinking bar upstairs where the movie Casablanca is always playing, and the billiard board in the room, which always had the money on number 22. She hired a talented Moroccan musician, Issam Chaba. He sits at the grand piano every night. Kathy Krieger is gone now. Issam is the operating manager of the place. Krieger's son will take over and keep her legacy alive. Talented.
The world will always welcome lovers as time goes by.
The average commute in 2017 was 26.9 minutes, inching up just slightly from 26.6 minutes the year before. All told, that means U.S. commuters spent an extra 2.5 hours in traffic last year. Joining us now is Gridlock Sam Schwartz, a traffic expert who, as New York City traffic commissioner, popularized the term gridlock. Sam, any surprise that commute times are ticking up?
No, not at all. A lot of things are going up. We've been watching vehicle miles traveled over the last few years. They surprisingly went down for about 10 years from 2004, 2005, because younger people, millennials, were driving a lot less. But what's happened since 2015, population's grown. More people have gone out and bought cars. More people are working. And so vehicle miles traveled has gone up. And when vehicle miles travel go up, especially in dense areas, travel times go up with it.
And those dense areas, those major metropolitan areas in this country, it seems are the places where the economy is doing better than in more rural areas. There might be more people living in those places who have to get to work.
Yeah, absolutely. So we see that in Washington, D.C. We see that in New York City and a number of others. And it's also a combination of not just the vehicle miles traveled by the commuters, but we also have new forms of transportation that we never had before, such as Uber, Lyft in New York City, VIA, and they stay in motion a good deal. They have a much greater impact than a car that just drives in, goes to a parking lot or garage, and doesn't move during the course of a day.
Well, there are some people who probably look at the results of this survey and say it's all Uber's fault that the traffic is going up. But do you think that's true or not?
No. I think there's a fair amount of impact. As you get closer to the central business areas, a much smaller impact when you're 10, 20 miles away. Some impact in our central business districts in New York City, for example, speeds over the 5 or 6 years that Uber and others have been in existence have dropped from a very slow 6.5 miles an hour to 4.7 miles an hour. And a fair amount of that could be attributed to the app-based car services, but also we have a lot more trucks making these tiny deliveries with Amazon and other services that will deliver to you within an hour. So it's not just all the app-based services, but that is a big impact when you get to the center of cities.
What about the view that if traffic is going up, and it has been going up for a while, that cities should just be spending more on public transit so people can get in without having to sit on the highway in traffic?
Cities should be figuring out a much more efficient way to use their space. and it is not efficient to have a single occupant car coming into the city that occupies a tremendous amount of space. Mm-hmm. Very inefficient. If we double that to two people per car, we'd solve the traffic problem in many areas. We should also be encouraging public transportation. And there's another tool, and that's one that I recommend we use in the densest of areas, and that's congestion pricing. We charge people to enter, which does a number of things. Those people that are remain in their cars, they'll be moving faster. The second thing will be raising revenue for infrastructure, for roads, bridges, and transit.
That is Sam Schwartz, who is a traffic expert and former New York City traffic commissioner. Thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
The midterm elections are less than 50 days away, and Senate Democrats are playing defense and offense at the same time. More than half of the 49-member caucus is up for re-election this year. Democrats have to hold on to all of those seats, plus pick up two more in order to win control of the Senate. This week for our Senate Tracker series, we're taking a look at Wisconsin's Senate race, where Democrat incumbent Tammy Baldwin is facing Republican challenger Leah Vukmir. Laura White covers state politics for Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Laura, welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And let's start with Senator Baldwin. She is a first-term senator trying to make it to two terms right now. She is the most liberal of the 10 Democrats up for re-election in states that Trump won. Tell us more about her.
So Baldwin has been a political figure in Wisconsin for quite a long time now. She served three terms in the state legislature before she was elected to the House in 1998. And then, of course, as you mentioned, to the Senate in 2012. And that other thing that you mentioned about her voting record and how people perceive her as a liberal senator is something that has really been picked up on in this campaign. Her opponent, Leah Vukmir, is trying to paint her as sort of a far left liberal who's out of touch and unrealistic.
Hmm. And let's listen to one of her ads. This is from August, when the Republican primary was still going on.
This message. Who'll stand up for Wisconsin jobs? Tammy Baldwin has worked to make sure our government buys American and hires American. But Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson disagree. Vukmir says buying American is too expensive. And new reports.
So that's interesting to hear that. If you didn't know, you might think that that person doing that ad is a Republican, because buy American sounds like something President Trump would say.
That's right. That's been a really interesting dynamic in this race as well. So Baldwin has really played up that particular area of agreement that she has with President Trump. So he came to Wisconsin several months ago and said that he completely 100% backed her Buy America legislation, which would require America to purchase American-made steel for certain infrastructure projects and certain water projects. And so she has said, hey, look at me. I can be bipartisan. I can work with the president on things. I'm not just going to blindly push back on him. And she and Wisconsin reporters, honestly, have tried to get her Republican opponents, whether that was the two opponents that faced each other in the primary or Vukmir now, to say where they stand on this Buy America legislation. And they haven't been exactly forthcoming about their opinions on it.
Well, tell us about Leah Vukmir. She is a former nurse and has emerged as a formidable contender. What should we know about her?
So Vukmir is a really interesting candidate, I think, even for people outside of Wisconsin, because people, I think, outside of Wisconsin, it's safe to say if you're tuned into politics, you know who Scott Walker is, our governor. He had his short-lived presidential bid. And Leah Vukmir is kind of the product of Scott Walker's Wisconsin Republican political machine in a lot of ways.
Let's listen to one of her ads. This one opens in a darkened house as the answering machine plays menacing voicemails in the background. Vukmir is sitting at the table with a handgun on it.
I know where you live, and I'm going to come for you. You're going to die, and I'm going to be the one who does it.
Ever have someone threaten your life for what you believe in? I have. When Scott Walker and I beat the union bosses, cut billions in taxes, and defunded Planned Parenthood, the left couldn't take it. With President Trump, we can do the same in Washington. Standing on principle takes guts. I know what it takes. I'm Leah Vukmir.
Tell us about what she's talking about in this ad.
So I believe she is referencing voicemails that she received when our Act 10 legislation, which those from outside Wisconsin who aren't necessarily familiar with that vernacular here, those are the collective bargaining changes that Scott Walker pushed shortly after taking office that rolled back a lot of the collective bargaining rights of state employees in Wisconsin. And so Vukmir received some of those voicemails, I believe, during the process of that legislation moving through the legislature, which was, of course, incredibly polarizing. There were a lot of protesters at the Capitol, particularly teachers. That was a big population that was there for the protests. And Vukmir saying that, you know, they were using violent language, but she says that she wasn't intimidated by it in a way that would deter her or derail her from her political goals. And she's hoping that really resonates with voters, I think.
So when we hear those two ads, and we're talking about unions and we're talking about buying American, it sounds like the economy is the big issue in Wisconsin. Is that the case, or what are the big issues voters are caring about this year?
Well, the economy is certainly a big issue, but I think in this particular Senate race, it's been interesting to see healthcare really rise to the forefront. Most political reporters that you talk to in Wisconsin would agree that healthcare is really the main thing that these candidates are tangling over right now. And I think that's for two reasons. One, Vukmir is a nurse. And so she's sort of talked about her experience and how that's informed her legislating. And, of course, the Affordable Care Act was something that Senator Baldwin worked on in the U.S. Senate. She was part of drafting the Affordable Care Act, was, you know, active in that. And she has also talked about her personal experiences with healthcare. She had a childhood illness that was fairly serious. So both of these women bring a personal perspective to the healthcare debate, and combine that with the fact that, you know, a possible repeal of the Affordable Care Act or keeping the Affordable Care Act and changing it up a little bit is really at the forefront of a national debate on politics. I think that kind of creates a perfect storm for it to be really the central issue in this Senate race.
What about the Kavanaugh hearings for the Supreme Court and that nomination? Is that playing into this race? Baldwin has already said she plans to vote no. Could that be a problem for her come November?
You know, I think that that's something that has certainly come up. Baldwin at first said she was going to meet with Kavanaugh. She was going to evaluate his record, and then she would make a decision. Pretty shortly after that, she said, I'm going to vote no. I know enough now. And now with these recent allegations, Vukmir has come to Kavanaugh's defense. So there's certainly a dynamic there at play. But I wouldn't say that it is an issue that has risen to the level of their sparring over healthcare or even their sparring over the opioid crisis and how Baldwin handled a particular incident with opioids at a state veterans hospital a few years ago.
What was that?
So what happened there was in 2015, there was a scandal about a doctor at the VA overprescribing opioids. Baldwin has acknowledged that things didn't go as they should. She disciplined a member of her staff. But Vukmir is saying, look, Baldwin didn't do enough to stand up for Wisconsin veterans. And so she says that kind of leadership is really inexcusable and not what we need right now.
What are the polls saying?
The polls are really interesting because we had a new poll come out this week that has Baldwin with an 11-point lead, which is a major shift from the last poll we got, which had her just out by 2 last month. So these issues and this debate over the past month, at least in this survey, have worked in Baldwin's favor.
You know, you mentioned the governor, Scott Walker, who is definitely a conservative Republican in Wisconsin. We also think of Wisconsin as the state that produced Russ Feingold, who was a very liberal Democrat. Why do you think Wisconsin has these two opposite sides of the political spectrum that managed to get elected?
It's just that's the million-dollar question. There are these incredibly strong, incredibly different political forces at work here. Wisconsin has that progressive history. Wisconsin was the birthplace of a lot of progressive ideas, kindergarten, workers' compensation, a whole host of things. I think it's the the makeup of the state, and I don't want to say that our urban-rural divide is any different from certainly other places across the country that have, you know, some more liberal voting centers in their urban areas and a more rural population. And as economic times have changed, as there's been a shift away from manufacturing, et cetera, I think that political identity as a progressive state has come to be at odds with other forces, economic, social, et cetera, that has led to the rise of Scott Walker and sort of those pragmatic economic changes, the things that he has pushed for in recent years and been very successful.
That's Laurel White, who is state politics reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurel, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And you can find our other Senate Tracker conversations at hereandnow.org. We're doing one every week until the election. Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban will make a $10 million donation to organizations that support women in the workplace and victims of domestic violence after an independent investigation concluded that he fostered a misogynistic work environment. Yesterday, Cuban apologized on ESPN to the women who suffered physical abuse and sexual harassment by Mavericks employees.
And not just to them, but their families, because this is not something that just is an incident and then it's over. It stays with people, it stays with families, and I'm just sorry I didn't see it.
Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us now to talk about this and other news in sports. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
The findings of this independent investigation that took months to complete were made public yesterday, and they confirm some of the allegations first reported by Sports Illustrated that there is a corporate culture, quote, rife with misogyny and predatory sexual behavior, according to some of the current and former employees. The investigation, though, found no wrongdoing by Mavericks owner Mark Cuban himself. Could you explain that for us?
Yeah, most of the harassment and the allegations, and now we could say the documented allegations, centered on the former CEO, Tadirma Usery, and he is out. He is replaced by Cynthia Marshall. And I do have to note that Sports Illustrated did a great job and sort of blew this story wide open almost 2 years ago, and there was a follow-up that resulted in this accounting and this large donation, which was actually four times the amount that could be mandated by the NBA. So in a sense, Cuban went above what was just mandated. But as I read the NBA commissioner's statement about it, he does do everything to distance Cuban and the current Mavericks from the harm that was caused. And I get the sense that they're trying to cauterize the wrongdoing. And that might be the case. That might be an accurate representation of where the Mavericks were and where the Mavericks are. But it does strike me that there is a very conscious effort to say, well, that's no longer us now. And who knows? I mean, there's a lot of indication that unless you really get to the root cause, this goes on. And Mark Cuban himself says he wasn't attentive enough to the business. So who is to say he has vowed to reform, but who is to say he will be sufficiently attentive now? And not just this one business out of the 30. What about the other 29 NBA franchises?
So is he as leader then off the hook? Is there any talk of him leaving the organization or selling the team? And do you think there should be or not?
He was asked that, and he said, no, no one asked me to sell the team. And he put it in this term, I am not someone who walks away from my problem. So he is saying that by not selling the team, I am taking ownership of the problem. And he is also, the NBA backs him up on that. And he is, you know, with a $10 million donation, which is, as I said, above what they could have mandated and targeted to women's groups and women's in leadership. He's certainly trying to make a statement and backing it up with money.
Mike, in other NBA-related news, we found out that the long-rumored sequel to the 1996 movie Space Jam is in the works, although this time, instead of Michael Jordan and a cast of Looney Tunes characters, it will star LeBron James. What do you make of this?
Right, LeBron. Now, we can say that LeBron James has already starred with a cast of Looney Tunes characters. That was last year's Cavs. ba-dum-bum. God, it's always bad when you have to provide your own ba-dum-bum. I don't think it's a sequel. We're not sure what it's going to be, but from what has been reported, and this is being treated like a huge secret, like a state secret, but it has been reported that Space Jam will actually be a reboot, and Ryan Coogler, who directed Creed and who directed Black Panther, he's going to be the executive producer. For people of a certain generation, which is a generation slightly younger than my own, man, they love Space Jam. I was just a guy in my early 20s who said, this isn't such a good movie.
Well, I remember it, but the first thing that popped into my head was, I guess they're not going to be able to use R. Kelly's song,
yeah,
I Believe I Can Fly, at the end of the...
That'd be awkward. Yeah.
Mike Pesca, just want to follow up on something that happened last weekend. Buffalo Bills cornerback Vontae Davis abruptly retired from football right during halftime. He said later in a statement that he suddenly realized, I shouldn't be out here anymore. He's gotten some pushback, including from NFL players and former players. What are you hearing right now, and how much pressure is he facing?
Well, he's done with the game, and he says that leaving was therapeutic, and he gave he put out a statement and gave a larger interview to The Undefeated, and I'll read you some of it. I left everything the league wanted me to be, playing for my teammates while injured, the gladiator mentality. It all just popped. He apologized, says it wasn't about his teammates, but for the first time ever, it was about himself. And you could say that he let down the team. He literally let down the team. You know, he was slotted to be the number one quarterback, a cornerback on the team. They have a hole now. So that's bad. That's bad if you're a Bulls fan. For Vontae Davis, his physical health, his mental health. I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but there is something called being other directed versus knowing what your own values are. And it seems it's very hard in an organization like the NFL or the sport of football to actually know what your own values are and sometimes to go against the team. The virtues of being a football player is to be part of the team, but sometimes it's the brave thing to go against the team. At least it seems for Vontae Davis, for all forms of his health, that seems to have been the right choice for him.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst, also editor of the new book, Upon Further Review, The Greatest What-Ifs in Sports History. Thank you, Mike. I'm Lisa Mullins. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.